Welcome back to another episode of the Magnus and Marcus podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, the coach at the University of Houston and the author of The Science of Running. I am joined by John Marcus, philosopher of running and coach of High Performance West. Welcome back, John.
Always good to be back and give the people what they want.
That's right. Another day, another podcast. Another day of coaching and running and all that good stuff. It's never a bad day when we can talk about things. So, also with the start of probably college cross country seasons and the return to high school and college classes and cross country and all that good stuff, we thought we'd take on a little bit different of a topic, and that is the business side of the sport, or the, as you put it, the businessification of the sport. So why don't you take a moment and explain what you mean by that before we go diving in?
Yes, the businessification of athletics and coaching, you know, more focused at the scholastic level, you know, really, you know, post-collegially, it's a business, you know. No one can ever forget that if you're training post-collegially with aims of making a crack at being a professional runner or semi-professional, meaning that you compete for money or you aim to compete to win money, you know, that's par for the course. But I think as it's kind of pertinent to the scholastic background, you're seeing increasingly, and I'm, you know, had several talks with colleagues recently about this businessification of athletics and how in the academic world, you know, athletics originally was supposed to be part of your education, as philosophy class taught you one thing, a foreign language taught you another. Participating in athletics at the high school and secondary, you know, collegiate backgrounds was supposed to deliver another cornerstone of a very well-rounded education. And, you know, in this day and age, in such a hyper-specialized world, and also, too, with big dollars now at stake, supposedly, for administrators, coaches, and even projected a few lucky athletes, you're seeing us become a lot more business-oriented in how we approach sport, which sport always has been and always will be a crucible of unpredictability when the game is not rigged or enhanced one way or the other. And, you know, I think that's a problem that needs to be discussed and chewed on a little bit. And people just need to be made aware of to see how their daily actions within their particular purview, whether it's as a high school coach, college coach, or post-collegiate coach or club coach, you know, can have a positive impact to kind of yield us away from the slippery slope that we're on and potentially going down even further.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed that at the high school level, the college level, even, I mean, as you said, the professional level is almost always a business. But there's this forgetting, and I think this comes back to coaches' education, and more so than education, I think it comes to how coaches and administrators generally end up in their job now. And our podcast interview with Vern Gambetta, we talked a little bit about how coaches found their path and how their path is different now than it was. It used to be in the past where coaches were educators first and then got into coaching. And now more so you see them as athletes who then get into coaching, and there's no education step in there. And I think you see the same thing on the coaching and administrative staffs is in the past, your athletic directors at your high school or your ADs in college came with a coaching background. Like they had some sort of skin in the game with coaching, and they worked their way up through the system and ended up in the spot they were because of their coaching acumen and all that good stuff. But I think now more so than ever, you're finding that the organization of and management of sport is being taken on by the kind of the guys in the suits, right? The guys who come with the business school background. One of my good coaching colleagues likes to refer it to as they all go to the school of athletic directing, and they all kind of have the same mantras and same ideas and same look that you get now. And I think, well, there are some positives to that. I think it comes with it shifts the emphasis from what we're looking at getting out of athletes from a coaching standpoint to a, let's look at how beneficial this is in terms of a, what do we get in return from our investment in these athletes?
Yeah. When you start talking about KPIs, ROIs, CFEs, you know, all these isms and things and analytics and matrix to track success, based solely upon productivity or performance, you know, you start to lose the soul and spirit about what coaching and athletics is. And granted, yes, you want to know what a win is in your industry. You want to know what a win, you know, is from performance matrix. Like, we need to have progress, and we need a purpose, you know, pushing towards that progress. But, you know, the spirit of coaching, the spirit of athletics can't be lost. And unfortunately, you know, I've been struggling with this a lot with my own thoughts and talking to colleagues and mentors and peers, you know, the last couple of months, just about what path we're headed with, you know, the increased exposure and transparency, you know, afforded to us by social media. You know, now we're on the ball about injustices or federations acting rather shadily or corruptly, or individuals or companies. You know, all that's so much more transparent now than it has ever been in the past. And has it been going on in the past? Of course, at the same level, maybe even more, because there wasn't this degree of sharing, instantaneous sharing in education that we have now. But it doesn't mean we need to get out and be, you know, very dilapidated and bemoan the end in the of the sport of, you know, athletics, running, track and field, etc. You know, I think it's healthy. All this transparency is coming to light with, you know, Rule 40, you know, various doping drug scandals, you know, federation or administration corruption. Like, those things need to be there, and that dirty laundry needs to be aired publicly. So it's a a marker for, let's not go down this path again. Let's not go do this again. And as coaches and athletes, you know, it can cause a lot of depression, I feel like, because it's like, well, why even try if the game's rigged? You know, but it's not. It misses the point of athletics, of sport. The point of sport is education. It's experiencing, growing, learning, knowing more about who you are in the crucible of competition, how you prepare for that competition, how you react and respond to that competition, and then having that mentorship or support network there to help pick you up when you fail or celebrate when you succeed. And that, time and time again, is why I keep coming back to my enthusiasm for what I do, rather than just completely walk away and say, that's it, I'm opening a coffee shop about.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, especially with the Olympics coming up, is this. Is the point of the sport has been lost, right? If we look at the Olympic Charter, for example, I did this the other day when everything was going down in the IOC and the craziness that it was. You look at the Olympic Charter, and there's probably not one single one of those principles that the Olympic Committee and the Olympics stands for. There's not one single one of those ideals that we actually truly follow, right? Because it's become this huge enterprise that is not about those ideals, but is about making money, right? And that's fine. Like, we need to make money, and organizations set out to make money. But I think it's hidden behind this facade of, oh, this is the Olympics. It brings everyone together and all this stuff. And it actually doesn't. And I think part of the problem we see now, in the sense that so many corruption scandals and so many cover-ups, is that just like we've seen in, you know, investment banking or other businesses in the past, is that the culture has shifted so far away in the wrong direction that we lose the forest from the trees. And I think my biggest scare is that you're starting to see that more at the college and even at the high school level, where the high school level used to be about competition and sport and passing on lessons and, you know, development, where now it's those, whatever you want to call them, KPIs have shifted completely to where it's our definition of success has translated to mean solely wins and losses, or solely times run. And I think even looking back to when I was in high school, is our coach put an emphasis on winning, but to a degree it was more so, or he cared more so about developing every single person from the top to the bottom. And you had those, and the thing about cross country that was so great is you had those people who ran, you know, 28 minutes for 5K and came out, you know, 50 pounds overweight, but our coach would still let them try. And I think we're losing some of that culture aspect more towards this win at all costs motto.
Yeah, and you know, we tend to mimic what the elites or what the top does, right? As we try to, you know, better our craft or learn, or you know, this explosion of information that's readily shareable, you know, workout Wednesdays, and here's what the best of the best are doing, and here's what they prioritize, so we should prioritize this too. And you see this actually, sadly, a lot more in the high school ranks, where it's all about this time. And if you run a fast time as a high school kid, as you know, you're deemed a prodigy, and then you have this, you know, huge upside of potential. But also, as you know too, Steve, it doesn't mean that upside is ever going to be realized. You know, and that's the hard sell here, is people are trying to invest in a stock early, invest in an athlete early. And you see it with more shoe companies signing 18, 17-year-old kids who are juniors and seniors in high school, having them forego being on a competitive collegiate team, instead thrusting a kid right into the ranks of professional track and field and saying, okay, now develop in this microcosm where the only thing that matters is making a team, performing for a medal, or achieving such a outlier mark that you're forced to just push your envelope, you know, to a point of, you know, collapse or a point of injury, because you're so ill-equipped. Because when you were having fun and it was easy, it was high school, there was just a sense of play involved, you were able to run fast, and that was cool, and you did it for like a season, or you did it, you know, at a meet and it caught someone's eye. And so it's almost like, in a lot of ways, we think it's a linear growth model, like you would if you signed a musician. You hear this raw talent in this bar, and you sign them, and you work on voice lessons, and they just get better and better and better and better at their craft, and they refine their motor skills with, you know, their guitar or piano, and it just gets better. And as we know in sport, that's not the case, because we don't have cuts, and we don't have edits, and we don't have the perfect studio sound to record that track. I mean, if you ever listen to a real live concert when the musician is singing, and they're really singing and not like lip syncing or voiceovering it, it sounds awful. You know, it doesn't sound good at all. But yet we're taking that model and applying it to sport so that there can be some certainty in the outcome, which to me is the exact inverse of what sport's all about.
Yeah, you know, and I think that brings up a good point. And I think that is actually a result of again, this business-like model of sport that we found ourselves in, is we think that business, or we think that scientific, even to a degree, means certainty, right? And we want to control all these parameters that we really can't control. So what it does is it brings us towards this, as you said, this linear growth model, because we think like, oh, this is scientific. Like, oh, this is business-like. Like, this is, we can model this, and then we can see if people follow this trajectory. And if they're not on our special trajectory, then forget them. Like, they're not going to be good, because that's what our model states. And it's almost this copying effect that I think you saw starting with baseball, when Moneyball and those other sabermetric type statistician driven parameters led, and I'm not against them, but I think what you see is you see a fake use of those, in the sense that in our sport it's got this linear growth pattern applied that just doesn't happen in the real world. I mean, to shamelessly plug my blog at scienceofrunning.com, like, I recently posted a progression data from the top 50 American, Canadian, and UK women's 800 runners. And if you look at the regression, if you average it all out, all 50 of them, then it looks relatively linear. But if you look at the app from an individual standpoint, you had some people who ran their best time at the age of 21 and some people at 34, right? And the journey to get there was all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. And in discussing this actually an hour ago with our good friend Phoebe Wright, who's also kind of a data science nerd. Sorry, Phoebe. she was like, man, her first comment to me was like, man, these shoe companies really are overpaying like prodigies. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, if you look at your data, like, prodigy doesn't mean you're going to go on this nice little path forward. Like, it's all over the place. Like, potential is this seductive thing that like ropes us in and grafts us in because, like, oh, at this age they've run this and they have so much potential. But we're making the mistake of thinking, A, they're young and they've run fast with potential. And the reality is we really didn't measure potential or assess potential at all. All we did was say they've run fast at this age. And then in our head, we've projected this linear growth model that doesn't exist and especially does not exist for prodigies, because with prodigies, it's an even more pronounced discrepancy than from the average, which, again, me being a data nerd, which I'll post some in the upcoming weeks or months, is if you look at the top 10 junior times of all times for Americans, is that prodigy growth is all over the place again. And the failure rate is much higher than the success rate for almost every single event. So,
right. I mean, and you know, you can just think of those prodigies and name them off the top of your head. I mean, you know, Alan Webb, German Fernandez, Chris Derrick, Steve Magnus, you know, like not all of them were wildly successful, you know, the more the previous or the subsequent years than previous years. It was peaks and valleys, ups and downs, because the thing about sport is it's life, man. You're not going to get better every single year in life. Some years are harder than previous years for unplanned and, you know, unknown reasons. And some years are, it all comes easy. It all comes smooth. And I think, you know, that's the thing is, you know, these sports marketing, you know, companies or agents in these companies, they oversell to themselves in you know, interior, the signing these prodigy athletes to like a 10-year contract. Like, my also curiosity would be, how long are those sports marketing reps in that position for 10 years to see that through? I mean, as we know it, you know, in corporate America, it's, you know, wildly insecure, just like every other competitive environment in the world. And so to think that you're going to be able to see your investment to fruition, you know, with a 10-year timeline, you know, except for the elite and select few in a very secure position, is probably not going to happen. So it's almost like, you know, it's kind of like credit card in a way. You're spending wildly right now in the moment, and it looks like a big win. But who's to say that car 10 years down the road is not going to depreciate in value for whatever reason? Like, you hope not. You hope it's a good, you know, long-term investment, and, you know, the proper support, coaching, competitive ops allow that. But, it, you know, coming back to it, what it's making is it an environment for athletes afraid to risk, afraid to lose, because the only way to protect that investment and continue that growth is to always win. And so what ends up happening is, you see this at the professional ranks. Many athletes race less and less year in and year out. They don't race that much except for the championship environment if they already have the qualification mark, and they choose to rather practice because they can make more errors in practice and save face in practice. But if they go out not fully prepared and get beat by, you know, some, you know, small name or no name type, you know, athlete, then all of a sudden it's like, uh-oh, what's wrong? What's wrong? And all, you know, and all the sirens go off. But that's sport. I mean, we don't throw our hands up in the air and go, what's wrong with LeBron James if the Cleveland Cavaliers lose one game? You know, we don't say, oh, what's wrong with Steph Curry? You know, the Warriors, they lost. Like, something's wrong with them. Oh no, their stock's going down. Like, they have another opportunity to get back on and go compete and, you know, try to put their team in position to win. And it should be the same in sport, but yet we have this weird homeostasis mindset that if anything rocks the balance of power or the balance of this person has this PR and should be at this level and that doesn't transfer, then, you know, we get all twitchy, and we do that too at the scholastic level. I mean, how many times have you, you know, we've talked to colleagues or had an athlete where they ran this, you know, 148.800 at Mount SAC, and like, okay, they're going to be ready to go. Okay, conference, man, they're just going to crush. And then they run a 152 at conference, and you're like, what? How'd you get worse? And it's not that they got any worse. It's just they were ill-prepared or ill-equipped to, you know, continue to compete with that early success or that early fast mark as this outlier or as this definition of who they now became. You know, and I always try to remind athletes I work with, what you are is the, you know, how fast you are is the culmination or the sum of your three best marks that season, not last season, not two seasons ago. You know, and a lot of people do struggle with that. You know, friends and athletes that we know are like, well, I ran 159 for 800 as a female mid-distance runner 3 years ago, and now I'm only running 202. What's wrong with me? It's like, nothing's wrong. That's still pretty competitive, but nothing's wrong just because you ran that one fast time once 3 years ago and it never came again. Like, nothing's wrong.
Well, I think that's part of the problem. Again, if you look at, you know, you use basketball as an example, so I'll use that too. Is if you look at LeBron James or Steph Curry, they're not on every single night that they play, right? And we accept that. Like, we're okay with that because we haven't set it up where it's like either you score 50 points in the game or you're a failure. But in the sport of track, we have. It's either you score your 50 points in this game, whatever that 50 points means for you in terms of your PR, or you failed. And because of that, we set up this environment where it's very, we want this certainty of, oh, I'm going to come to this meet and I'm going to run well because I'm ready to run well and it's in perfect conditions and all that stuff. And well, maybe from a performance PR standpoint, that's done well. As a sport, it's killed it. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely decimated the sport of track and field because the matchups aren't there. The excitement isn't there. Excitement doesn't come from running, you know, 3:45 in the mile. Excitement comes from a battle and competing. It doesn't come from, you know, running super fast times. If you run 3:50 in the mile versus 3:55 and I don't have a clock on it, I can't tell the difference between it. You know, in all honesty, if I was watching Nick Willis run a mile and anyone was, you would probably guess he was running slower than he was, than he actually is, because he looks so smooth doing it. Right? So it's not that these magic times make the meet great or the race great. It's that competition does. And we've gotten away from that because everybody wants to have that PR type race where they can control it. And again, going back to stats, like just to throw it in there, if you looked at the 800, if we had someone with a PR of 2 minutes, right? The year before, on average, they ran 201.7. The year after, on average, they ran 201.3. Okay. So what you're seeing there is like you said, 1 year's on, you have it, you popped it. Like, that's your PR year. That's great. And the year before and after are decidedly average compared to that. And that's okay. That's a regression to the mean. And I think like what that shows is that we have to get away from this is like, you're defined as your PR only. And this is what matters. And that's all that matters. And get back to racing and competition. And the other point on this that I'll make, before shutting up for a little bit, is that I think it's, you know, I think from a standpoint of whether it's high school, college, or even professional, where you have, governing bodies refusing to take athletes to the Olympics who have qualified, like the UK has, who have the qualifying standard because you don't think they're going to break through. I think that data shows is that, hey, if the average PR is 1.7 seconds slower than, you know, the year before, than what they run their PR year, that shows that breakthroughs to high level success, big PRs are the norm. Like, if I had an 800 runner who PR'd by, you know, over a second and a half in a year, I'd be exceedingly thrilled. But that is the average increase. Again, average. Some do, some don't. But the average increase of the top 50 Americans, when they hit their big time PR year. So I think breakthroughs are the norm, and we can't like limit people based on, oh, you've only run 2 minutes. Like, I never think you'll run 159 and compete.
Well, it's trying to create a recipe, you know, that's replicatable, you know, or that can be replicated, that can be replicated time and time again. And the reality is, when you start looking just at numbers of times, like, well, did you run this mark? And then these, you know, people in these committees or these suits, as you put it, just think, okay, if I take this person with said mark, this said mark is what their upper limit is, because that's all they've demonstrated or expressed up to this point, then they're going to achieve that said mark, you know, as their capacity. Again, loses the spirit of sport, because if I take a woman who's ran 201 flat, put her in the Olympics, and you know she's filled with a lot of like, you know, enthusiasm and patriotism and excitement, I mean, who's to say she's not capable of running 159 in that forum with 80,000 fans in the seats? I mean, you know, that and that's where it's lost. It's understood it there, you know, there are financial considerations for federations, and you know, just getting people, feeding people, housing people, putting gear in their back, like, you know, the story's a lot bigger than just, you know, a federation wanting or not wanting to take an athlete and having to make hard fiscal calls. You know, I understand that, but again, we're getting away from sport if we're just trying to have it be about the numbers. And that's what the businessification of sport does. It makes the performance solely about the number. So it'd be the same thing as a coach being like, okay, who am I going to start today in a basketball game? The guy who averages, you know, 23 points a game, or the guy who averages 12 points a game? But maybe the guy who averages 12 points a game also brings 10 blocks and, you know, 10 assists and 3 steals and averages a triple-double. But your you know, owner for your team says, oh, I want high-scoring games. You know, and so you just put in the person who has the best point average and then gun it and gun it and gun it, but you lose. The game's high scoring, but you lose. And this is what's happening here in sport, in athletics, is we're going for high scoring games, but we're losing because it's so sloppily executed. Like, people can't race in terms of tactics. It's not there because kids are just used to on the track for distance and middle distance race, just solely going after time trials. I mean, the fact that a 10K athlete gets maybe one shot, you know, if they're a post-collegiate before the championship, to run the qualifying time. And then what you do is, like, you look at the 10K on the track, and it's a sloppy event. I mean, a championship in the U.S. because all these guys and girls have ran this event once, maybe not even within the last year. It's the first time they've done it that year on the track for some as well. It's, you know, I mean, where's the tactics involved in that? And yeah, we say it's so hard now to run 6 miles, you know, on the track. And the reality is, it's not. I mean, people do workouts, you know, volumes of workouts twice that duration. And so, you know, because we're whittling it down to these numbers and we invest so much in these numbers, we lose the essence and are losing the essence of what makes this sport great. And you see it at the, you know, NCAA championships at all levels. You see it at the Olympic trials or US championships. Like, everyone's just out there racing. And that's what makes those meets awesome. And yet, up to the buildup before that, very few meets are just about solely racing. It's about getting the mark and getting out, maintaining your status on the descending order list, you know, for whatever qualification system you're trying to hit. And that's the essence. That's what we call racing. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, that's the disservice that we've lost with this, you know, in the last 40 years, getting away from all the dual meets and having that be a priority and this and that. And, you know, I get it that these are things people have been talking about and saying it's been the downfall of the sport for many, many years. But we're seeing it at a top-down level. And my fear is we're starting to impact the most developmental level in the high school and even middle school ranks, where it should just be about competing. You hear kids not, you know, as Vern said, not racing their state meet because they want to go run some fast invitational with the pros. Or, you know, these kids electing to just play it safe at the state meet and just run this one race instead of saying, no, go run a couple if you've qualified for it. I mean, I've always been a fan of, you know, giving people those high-level competitive opportunities, because we don't know if that's their last. I mean, they could get hurt, they could get sick for this or that reason, they leave the sport the next year. And yet you played it safe and said, we're only going to do a small number of competitive opportunities for you, because they all need to be at a Bravo level. But that's not how human beings work. It's not how we perform at a high level. It's not how we, you know, learn and grow. We need to fail, and we need to fail frequently so that we can be successful with more frequency down the road.
I always say, and I think it's sad that Billy Mills could not happen nowadays. Like,
yes, yeah,
you know, he couldn't. It wouldn't, because, you know, it just, it, you know, in outside of the U.S., first off, he wouldn't get selected. But A, he wouldn't be seen as a threat. B, it wouldn't have happened. And I think that's incredibly sad. And those moments, like, those moments that as track fans we point to are often, you know, from that era. Because it's like you didn't have as much of this controlled symbolism that we have now. You know, one of the things with actually the meet that's going on today, which will be done by the time you guys hear this, the Tracktown series meet, well, it's a cool concept and I hope it works and all that good stuff. One of the things that I was disappointed with is they announced rabbits for all the races, right?
Yes, yeah.
And here you have this team competition with incentives to win or place high or whatever, and you've got rabbits. So now we've dumbed it down to, you know, in a 1,500, 800, 1,000 meters of sitting around and then one lap that's exciting. And I think that that has just, you know, that has just harmed sport. And as you saw, as you said, like, you see it at every level now, and it's gone down to the high school level. And I get it. We want fast times and all that stuff, but I've harped on this a million times. But I think if you want to make track and athletics popular again, I think you have to take that out of the equation. I'd rather have no clocks on the races and see people race, and instead of being like, oh, this is super slow, like, this is super slow, let's hate on the athletes and boo on the athletes. I think it's like, talk it through, talk about how tactics matter and why this is super slow and who gets the advantage of it and who doesn't, instead of instantly being like, oh, tactical means horrible. No, it just means there's some sort of build or crescendo to something is going to happen exciting at some point. And I think the athletes in tactical races have, it's become bad recently, because when things go tactically, a lot of times athletes, because they've been trained on this sit around and sit and kick model of paced races, is they don't know how to inject any sort of variability in it. I think watching races in the 70s and 80s on YouTube, for example, or through old videos, is one of the cool things you used to see, especially with some of the early African athletes, is they would throw crazy surges. And you wouldn't know, it brought that uncertainty into sport. And I think in track, we have tried to become so certain through this, again, this kind of business-esque model, is that it's taken away the one thing that people watch sport for, and that is uncertainty.
Yeah, we've gone so focused on the science of running, you know, and the metabolism of running and being efficient and doing it. Here's the most efficient way to run the race. So always run the race like this, because this plays out to your advantage to be efficient. But you do see it. People are ill-equipped to handle champion-style racing, and people who ran really, really fast and like, oh man, they're a fast runner. But then they get in that crucible of like it being unscripted. And they're caught, you know, just flat-footed or, you know, inept and don't know what to do. And that's sad to see someone not really prepared. It's like fit. It's superficial preparedness. You're really fit. You've gotten yourself to a place of such fitness that you can do this at this red line level for this period of time on the track. But now it's like when we start to have tactics or slowing and surging or, you know, this and that, people don't know what to do. And then it all of a sudden, these athletes get super insecure and super down themselves. And unfortunately, you know, it just leaves a lot of fans, spectators, and coaches shaking their heads. And it's on the coach. It's on the coach to prepare the athlete for those unpredictable type races. And but yet, why should a coach, if they're only going to take them to the time trial races, you know, throughout the the season to get the fast mark. So it's this chicken and egg thing now, which that was what dual meets were about. Dual meets were about practicing tactics, you know, developing different types of tactics in a race in a low stakes environment so you could fail, but it wouldn't be that big a deal. So you're really well versed and prepared for championship style racing. You know, go ahead.
I was just going to ask. So since we're getting a little long on this, although we always go long, so it doesn't matter. But I'm going to, what do you think, how do you think we get back to the basics? Like, how do we right the ship and put sport in its rightful place? I know that's a big question. And we've talked a bit about like the small details of, oh, well, we need to make racing this, or we need to, you know, make this part of the culture. But like, what do you think the key takeaways are to get sport away from this kind of business model that we've talked about?
Well, I think it being a coach and being coach centric, you know, I think it starts with us. We have the greatest influence over the athletes. And, you know, at this classic level, it's not going and prepping for only the big all-star invitationals and having that be the end-all be-all. It's using different races if you're in a preparatory, like high school environment or even collegiate environment. It's using different races for different purposes, but yet sharpening the wheelhouse of competitiveness. So I remember when I was in high school, like we'd have a small dual meet. Maybe, you know, we are well advanced to the other team and the coach would be like, all right, guys, I want you guys to go out and try to set the course record. We're going hard from the first step. Just you guys, no pay, just go. Just no stimulus, just go try to set the course record. You know, and that will give us a reason to quote unquote make a statement. Or if there are a couple strong people that we might see maybe at a state meet or down the road, it's like, okay, hey, here's what I want you to do with them. You know, try this tactic. You know, see what, how they respond, see how you respond, you know, again, low stakes environment, but just try this out. And then that gives you better recon moving forward for that championship environment. You know, two, I think it's also as meet directors and being a meet director, you know, it's taking the emphasis off on pacing on certain meets. It's, you know, certain meets should be about racing and just saying, hey, there's no pacers. It's not, doesn't mean like, oh, because you're all saying, oh, there's no pacers. Oh, we can't run fast. Well, the only one who really wants pacers are like coaches and agents. The athletes, 9 times out of 10, don't care. The athletes just want to compete. And so I think, again, the having a pacer is for the to make the coach feel in control a little bit more. And as coach, we have to release control. So many coaches I know are control freaks, and it's a problem, and you need to stop. And I mean, I've tried to become a lot more autonomous, let my athletes be a lot more autonomous and a lot less controlling and a lot more absent. Like just being absent is not out of, you know, me being aloof or me not caring. It's, you're not going to learn with anything. No one's going to learn with the coach holding their hand the entire way, every step. And you're going to have to just figure it out, create some solutions, and then we can, you know, come back and we can, you know, decompress and we can chat. The other thing too is this idea that you need a highly integrated team of physio, nutritionist, sports psychologist, primary coach, secondary coach, strength and conditioning coach. Like, it's too much. We don't need all this crap. Like, I know a good friend who's a professional coach and he hired a full-time, like, you know, physio for his group, and it was a complete disaster. Is people got hurt more than they ever got hurt. They had little nicks that lasted a lot longer. The idea was to bring someone on board to help mitigate those losses from a business standpoint. But guess what? They increased it, not because they're not good at what they do. It's because they needed to do their craft. And so they needed to bill hours. So, hey, I'm going to adjust this. I'm going to work on that. I'm going to massage this. I'm going to stretch this. It's like, it's okay. But it's like me as a coach being like, hey, in any given day, there's all this coaching stuff I know we need to do. So we need to do drills. We need to do weights. We need to do med ball. We need to do, you know, core. We need to do stairs. We need to do strides. We need to do sprints. We need to do this. We need to do that. It's like, it's too much. Stop. Like, we can't poke and prod.
But, and you know, I often wonder, and having watched the Tour de France a little bit, not much at all, but a little bit while it was on last month, I think that part of the reason people feel like they need to do that is they see this false presentation
of good teams, whether it's Sky and the cycling or select running groups that we know, propagating this model that that's what you need. And I tweeted about this maybe last week, and it got me a bit of fire and heat. And that one of, and the Tour de France winner, Chris Froome, was quoted as saying, like, oh, I'm not going to release what we do as a team because it's highly individualized and it's a secret. And I don't want other teams having that advantage because they're all about these marginal gains and the science stuff. And I think that perpetuates this fraud that we need to have that kind of system in place. And I think I'm not anti-science, obviously. I'm not anti-physio. I'm not anti-strength coach, anything like that. But the really good groups who do it well, it's athlete-centered, and it's not about this system. It's just like, oh, what's best for the athlete? How do we get this done? And, you know, it being someone who coaches, I don't know, over a dozen post-collegiates who I never see ever, right? Yeah. it's kind of, which, you know, I mean, you were at the trials, like, we were supposed to meet up, and I was like, oh, I kind of want to go watch Sarah work out. She's doing her last tune-up workout. And you texted back, or you said, yeah, I can understand that. That's the first time you've seen her all year work out. And I'm like, yep, it is. So, you know, and it's like, not to downplay anything, but it's like, when I've seen that, whether it's Sarah or Neely or Natasha or anybody who I've had who's run relatively well, and they don't always run well, but who has run relatively well, is they've done it with zero system in place. It's me on the other end of a phone, you know, talking to them. There's no special strength coach. And granted, they have husbands and stuff like that who support, but it's not like this full-blown professional system. And
that's truly athlete-based. It's 100% accountability and ownership on the athlete.
Yeah,
you know. Exactly. And when you, my worry is when you take it and you divvy up the responsibilities amongst these different professionals who, again, I'm not against any of it. Like, they're all very good. But what can happen is you create less ownership on the athlete because I go see this person about this person about this person about this, that person about that. And all of a sudden, it's like you're seeing all these people have all these inputs on you, and it creates complexity. And we as coaches are supposed to, you know, do our job, be very, you know, energetic with our education, seeking out new knowledge, collaborating, just all this different stuff, and be in the middle of the complexity, and then take all the complex stuff that we digest and then deliver it to the athlete very simplified.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, one of the examples I like to use to get this message across is we've all seen that athlete who went home over the summer as a high school or college kid, took it upon himself, did everything you told him training-wise, took control of his training, right, and just had a monster summer. And then they come in really fit and are blazing and killing it. And then as coaches, we think, all right, this is great. We'll just load him up and get him sharp, and he's going to run really well. And then at the end of cross-country season, he tanks. And then we blame it on the kid for being like, oh, we pushed it too hard in the summer, right? And I think, well, sometimes that might happen. I really think a lot of it is, no, like, we took this kid who it was his responsibility. He took ownership for it, and he felt in charge and felt like he had a strong part in the training and all that stuff. We took a kid from that environment and transferred them to this environment where it is very coach-driven and where, okay, now you've taken responsibility. You are very autonomous, but now I'm going to tell you exactly what to do every single day. You're only doing exactly what I say, and we're going to have no conversation on it. And this is coach controlled, and you've taken all that autonomy away. And then I think he fails. And I think that happens more so than people realize it.
Well, and also it makes the coach feel like we're doing our job.
Yeah.
We're coaching. We're saying what to do, what not to do. Here's the practice plan. Follow the plan. And we'll get the result that, you know, is desired, because it's, you know, punch these numbers into the equation and formula, and you get this result out every time, every person. And that's the definition of a cookie cutter program. You know, one of my early mentors, he had for, you know, his group of distance runners, what he called champions run. And it was just an optional morning run that he did not run. He did not attend as a coach. And he put it upon the seniors or juniors and seniors, the upperclassmen, to take that autonomy to get those who they felt they could round them up and go run. And if you couldn't meet, you couldn't meet. But his message was champions, you know, champions are going to do this without authority figure present. And that's really what, you know, getting back to the businessification of sport, is that is what athletics is about, is athletes and people having the courage to act boldly in, you know, unpredictable circumstances and taking that risk. That's what we champion, is we champion the bold. And we're not seeing a lot of bold feats in sport or in athletics. And so there's nothing to get behind because it's all prescribed. It's all, you know, very much, you know, top down, whether it's a federation, a coach, you know, or a setup to create this desired outcome. You know, going back to basketball, I mean, that's the bold is the Cavs coming down from 3-1 to win the NBA finals. I mean, that's pretty bold. You know, the bold is, you know, any other kind of underdog in sport coming through and no one thought it was possible. Those are the ones you remember the most. Not that, oh, this team is supposed to win, they're so dominant, okay, great. You know, the Red Sox first World Series in the early 2000s after, you know, the curse, like that was bold, that was crazy. Those are the things that we champion, like the Oakland A's and the Moneyball. And then we try to take all this data, and Steve, you know, as a scientist, and I know too, there's so much data you can accumulate and collect, and the complexity of data that's out there, your job is to sift through it and get to the simple. Same thing as a coach. I find now more in my coaching practice that I am prescribing very simple, but very, you know, fundamental things to do on a consistent basis rather than going over and being highly complex. And I look at a complex thing or movement or drill or, you know, lift, and I try to break it down to really what's the simplest element from a, you know, movement standpoint or load standpoint that we're trying to get out of this, you know, and you know, trying to manipulate what that system is through however lens, whether it's heart rate, you know, different energy systems. I mean, you don't know at any given time if that exact energy system is being stimulated at this exact percent. That was just some study somewhere that we've taken and we ran with and we're like, okay, great. You know, but again, it's being aware this businessification is out there and, you know, understanding that there is some good that has come out of it. It has standardized a lot of things and made a lot of things a lot smoother. And it's a lot less, you know, bit of guesswork or just be tough for the sake of being tough and being out in the sun for 4 hours from grueling practices or daily doubles. But at the same time, too, you have to be keenly aware of it when it's there in front of you and know when and when not to apply it. And I think that's the hardest thing, is knowing when not to apply it, because we always feel like if we're not doing and pushing, pulling, prodding extra, we're actually falling behind. But 9 times out of 10, you talk to like the veteran experienced coaches who have been through it. It is the true, you know, the true cliche, you know, actually comes through and is a value here, where less really is more. But I should say it should be amended to be actually simple is more.
Man, that was brilliant. No, I love it. Because here's the thing, and then we'll wrap it up. Here's the thing. I think complex is a mask of uncertainty. When people don't know, they complexify, right? And there's all sorts of quotes on it, but if you're master of what you know, you simplify it. And I think we've gotten into this world of let's go super complex to show that, to make it seem like we know what we're doing. And whenever I see someone making a concept incredibly complex, I start doubting that they know what they're doing, eh? And I wonder why they are trying to complexify it to in case they're covering things up. You know, I think it was Frank Shorter. I tweeted this too. Frank Shorter tweeted that complex training, he thought, was a mask for doping. Right. And he was talking about the when he was competing, the Germans brought in all this complex sounding training and this all these models of periodization that made things look crazy with mesocycles and microcycles. And they had this track and field textbook that I own too that has like all this complex nature of how things are supposed to be programmed and how exercises are supposed to be timed at each time. And Frank Shorter's message was that this was a way to justify or to cover up what was actually causing the performance benefits, which for the East Germans was drugs,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they had to explain it. They had to say like, oh, like, why are these guys way better than everybody else? Where did they come from? Oh, wait, wait. It's because of our training. It's the example from the, I believe he was Irish 10K runner who tested positive for EPO once he went from like 29 minutes down to 27:30. He said, before he tested positive, they said, what's this massive minute and a half PR but in the 10K? Where'd that come from? Oh, you know, I changed my training up. I started adding plyometrics and box jumps and all these different drills and went through all these different drill things that he did. And he was like, that was the key. That's what caused my minute and a half improvement. And it turned out, no, it was you took EPL. Right? But we have to have that story to sell us. And I think wrapping things up, like, I think that's what you get sometimes when you create this businessification of sport, as you lose sight of what is important. And what takes place is making sure that we can tell this story of, oh, no, we have this linear like progression that everyone's supposed to go on, and see this little chart we made in this little graph, like, oh, that's fancy, isn't it? Like that's fancy. That's on a, we can stick that on a PowerPoint too. And that, you know, that this is the key. And I think people do that is, again, it's an excuse. It's a justification for things. And I think that's going down the wrong route. So in summing things up, I think that's kind of the message is be simple. But also, I liked your statement there. I might just tweet it. Having the courage to act boldly. If you remembered anything from the trials, you remembered what? Brenda Martinez making the team in third place in the 1500, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yep. You know, whatever else you say, that was a bold move to go from falling, collapsing, you know, well, falling, not making the team in your chosen desired event, and, you know, internalizing it and not complaining and being like, all right, brush off the shoulders, dust off the legs, let's do everything I can to make this team in the 1500.
Yeah, fortune favors the bold. I mean, that was the message to the athletes I had going into the trials. This is the message to my athletes now. If you want to succeed, if you want to put yourself in a winning position, if you want to win, like, you need to be bold.
Exactly. Because
no one ever remembers who got sixth at this Diamond League, sixth at this Oxy Invite. No one cares. But you remember the people who did bold things. And this is, you know, I was talking with a current professional middle distance athlete the other day, and we were just talking about how difficult it is to run consistently at the speeds of play that currently exist, you know, in professional track and field and the middle distance distances. It's very, very hard. I mean, it grueling wears and tears on your body. Alan Webb is example number one. You know, you can see everyone always asks about his status as a, you know, was he ever enhanced? And, you know, emphatically, no, there's no way, shape, or form. I know him, you know, yep. But even if I did know him, the way you can tell, variance in performance all over the place, ups and downs, big injuries, came back from injuries, because the wear and tear of how fast he wanted to run was so grueling. And, you know, and this is the difference between scholastic sport and professional sport. In the scholastic level, you have young men and women maturing, you know, going through puberty, and you'll see these huge drops. You'll see, oh man, I ran a 2:30 800 as a female, and in 2 years I ran a 2:15, or I ran, you know, as a guy, a 2:00 flat 800, and, you know, as a freshman, or even at the beginning of the season, and I'll run a 1:54, you know, at the end or something. Like, that happens. But then you get to this place where there is, you know, a ceiling of sorts, and then you're training twice as hard for incrementally, you know, incremental improvements. But that's that's the game at the professional level. And again, we don't ask LeBron James to average 50 points a night, you know, in this modern era. You know, no, they're like, oh, no one's ever going to eclipse Will Chamberlain's 50-point average season, you know, when he scored. No one's asking anyone to score 100 points a night. And yet that's what we're asking, you know, our professionals to do here in athletics, is to do that insurmountable feat. And, you know, you just have to remember that it's because we detracted the competitiveness and the competitive opportunities and the narratives for those competitive head-to-head matchups away in the last couple decades. Now, if we get, you know, back to that, and we as coaches and athletes are training our people to be competitive, like be physically fit and prepared and tactically sound, which we're missing right now, then I think we're going to have a good shift in the right direction. And the business will get better for everybody. It won't just be about how fast or how far or how long. It will be about how did you win? What are the subtleties there? And then people will become more students of the sport and be more excited. So I'm optimistic, you know, that I think with all the transparency that's coming to the forefront in this day and age, and people like yourself see, you know, speaking out if they see wrong or, you know, whatever, like we need more of that, not to bring any people down or to, you know, bring anyone through the mud, but just because we, in order to be a better business and to be able to be more sustainable and to grow, that we need to get back to our roots, which is competition. And that's the beauty of our sport and why I love it so much, is it's just, this is the classroom that you can teach young men and women and even older men and women a lot about themselves through competition. So, you know, for everyone listening that's getting ready to get back at this fall, just remember that, you know, the cross country course or the track, it's a classroom, and make sure, you know, you as a coach, you're helping those athletes learn those valuable lessons in that setting that they can get nowhere else.
Well said. Well said. Well, actually in there.
There you go. Now one.
That's it. All done. But I will say, sorry, speak up. I'm with you 100%. I think calling out inadequacies or unfairnesses is something that needs to be done. And it's not about taking people down, but it's about transparency. And we're in a unique day and age where everybody plays a role on transparency. And it's something that I think can fundamentally change sport. So I know everyone's scared to say anything controversial, but being vocal if you see something that is not right is the way to do it. And if anybody has any problems with that, they're welcome to tell me about that thing, and I'll take the hit and I'll vocalize it, because hey, I'm in that position where I can say whatever I want almost, because I've already, you know, gone
down.
You've
already been bold. Continue to be bold, people. That's the message. There we go. Be bold.
All right. And thanks a lot for listening. We appreciate you guys listening, and yeah, keep it real.